This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bean Cooley of the website TV Worth Watching, in for Terry Gross. Drummer Levon Helm, whose great drumming and singing was a key element of the group The Band, died yesterday at the age of 71 of complications from throat cancer. Levon Helm sang lead vocal on such classic tracks by The Band as The Night They Drove Old Dixie Down, Up on Cripple Creek, and The Wait. As John Pareles wrote in today's New York Times, quote, "In Mr. Helms's drumming, muscle, swing, economy, and finesse were inseparably merged. His voice held the bluesy, weathered, and resilient essence of his Arkansas upbringing in the Mississippi Delta," unquote. When the band's album Music from Big Pink came out in 1968, it was an event in the music world. And their follow-up album was just as impressive. It included this song, on which Helm sang lead vocal.
We were hungry, just barely alive. By May the 10th, Richmond had fell. It's a time I remember oh so well. The night they drove old Dixie down, and the bells were ringing. The night they drove old Dixie down, and the people were singing. They
On today's show, we're going to hear two interviews Terry recorded with Levon Helm. First, a 1993 interview about his work with The Band, and then a conversation recorded in 2007 after Levon Helm recorded Dirt Farmer, his first solo album in 25 years. The Band first got together as the Hawks when they backed an energetic rockabilly singer from Arkansas named Ronnie Hawkins. Levon Helm was from Turkey Scratch, Arkansas. The other members of the band were from Canada. Soon after they broke from Hawkins to form their own group, they got a call from Bob Dylan. He was looking for a band. That's where we'll start Terry's 1993 interview with Levon Helm.
So what was it like when you got the phone call, when Bob Dylan called and said he was looking for a band? This was at about the time that like a Rolling Stone was a hit on the radio.
That's right. Rolling Stone was out, and I think that was that particular album was the first time that Bob had used a band, and it was something new, something that he wanted to do. And I didn't know a whole lot about Bob. We were more into R&B and blues music. And
well, in fact, you're right that you thought he was too folky.
Well, we weren't big folk fans. We were more we liked more instruments. We liked rhythm section. We liked horns. We liked a full house on the bandstand. And Bob was coming from more of a troubadour, you know, just him and his guitar kind of a place. And I didn't really know who he was. I hadn't connected the name with the song Like a Rolling Stone that was playing on the radio, and he called us down at Tony Mart's in Summers Point, New Jersey, and asked if we wanted to play the Hollywood Bowl with him, and I said, sure, you know, who else is going to be on the program? And he said, just us. And we asked the Colonel, our agent, if Bob could fill up the Hollywood Bowl, and the Colonel said that he thought he could. And we had a couple of rehearsals, and we ended up playing Forest Hills with Bob. A couple of us, Robbie and myself, came out of our group, and he had Harvey Brooks and Al Cooper that he had played with, up at Newport.
You know, when he played at Newport, he was booed at the Newport Folk Festival. He was booed by the crowd there because he had just gone electric, which was very controversial. So,
yeah. Well, he was booed when we went electric with him at Forest Hills,
right. Well, did he give you advice on what to do if you got booed?
He told us, we had a little huddle there backstage before we went on for the second half. He played the first half by himself, and it went just smooth as silk, and the crowd loved it. And the second half, we huddled, and we knew we had read and heard about things getting a little bit tough in Newport. He told us, whatever happens, don't stop playing, just keep playing, and give it a chance to settle down. And we did, and I don't know if it ever settled or not.
You left the band shortly after it became Dylan's backup band. Why did you leave it? I mean, this was like, in retrospect, a great opportunity for the group.
Well, it was, and, I probably could have been smarter about it, but we had played most of the American part of the tour. Bob wanted to play Europe. He wanted to go to Australia, and so we played through the Northeast, which was pretty tough. Towns like Boston, they gave us a standing ovation of boos, and at the same time, we would hit Fort Worth, Texas, and it would be just another good rock and roll party. But it started wearing on me, I got to the point where I couldn't find enough funny things to laugh about it. I didn't feel like joking around all the time like I usually do. And rather than really make a boner, I decided that maybe I should let the tour go ahead to Europe and to Australia and some foreign places without running the risk of making a monkey out of myself. So I stayed back and waited on everybody. I went back to Arkansas and played with the Cate Brothers Band and kind of picked up where I'd left off playing dances and so forth.
So you rejoined the band after the band moved to the Catskills, which was after Bob Dylan's motorcycle accident.
Yes, ma'am. He had a bike, spilled his bike after they got back, so it kind of changed directions, and instead of so much touring, there was a lot of extra time, to put music together, and Garth set up his Ampex tape machine in the basement there at Big Pink, and we started getting together and just putting songs together, and trying our voices, finding out how to stack our harmonies and just things like that that helped us out later on.
So when you moved to the Catskills and the band was living in a house that was pink and was nicknamed Big Pink, did you move into the house with them?
Yes, I did. Moved into the house there. There was an extra spot for me, and we used it as our headquarters and music room for a couple of 3 years there.
What was it like to all live together and play together? It could get very insular. You could really get on each other's nerves in a situation like that.
Well, not for us. We had been doing this for years. We had traveled and shared the same bedroom and bed on different occasions. There had certainly been times when maybe we could afford two rooms, and after a few flips of the old coin, we found out who was going to get the couch and who might get an extra pillow and take the floor. So, no, we got along good, and things were a lot of fun for us. We had never had that kind of time on our hands. We had come from the school of playing six nights a week and a dance on Sundays if we could manage it. And, of course, Ronnie Hawkins could usually manage to book that extra night. So all of a sudden, there we are in the Catskills, and we don't have a show to play that night. So we were enjoying it, just sitting around and, the freedom to go down and play some music or go outside and throw a football around at each other.
The band's name was not initially supposed to be The Band. What was it supposed to be, and how did you end up with the name of The Band?
We didn't know what it was supposed to be, and we had signed an agreement with Capitol Records. It hadn't come to that yet. We were trying to sign an agreement, and we ended up signing the agreement as The Crackers, and we thought that was funny. Nobody else did, especially the record company.
Was the joke that everybody except you was from the North?
Well, we tried the Honkies just for variety, and they didn't think that was too funny either. But people referred to us as the band. You know, Bob's at the hotel, and the band is headed for the sound check. So, on the Big Pink record, when it came time for the credits to list everybody's names, I think it said something like the band, and then underneath it, it told you who all was in the band. So when we cut our second record, the record company kind of shifted that back around, and they liked that better than the Crackers.
It's funny, here was this band that had been on the road together for so long, right? And now that you had gotten used to recording in the basement and had an album out, you didn't really want to go on the road.
Well, you know, by the time we got our record recorded, we had learned a whole lot more than we had ever known before about our, you know, the way we sounded and the different combinations we could use by changing instruments around. So we didn't want to go on the road. We wanted to continue to record and try and refine some of our formulas, you know, to help us do better music, and we thought the closer we stuck with it, now that we had learned the fundamentals of playing music in a recording studio, we didn't want to go back to playing live and forget what we had learned. We wanted to kind of keep honing that particular style of chops. It's different playing in a studio than it is playing live, of course. So We had managed to develop some studio chops, and we didn't want to back away from it that quick.
When did things start going bad for the band, within the band? Dissension and things like that. I mean, for example, you write in the book about how really annoyed you were when you'd see on records that Robbie Robertson had all the songwriting, or most of the songwriting credits.
Well, that was a bit of a distraction. I didn't think it was quite fair. Not that Robbie didn't do a lot of the songwriting, most of it in some spots, but at the same time, Richard did some good work, and I always thought that that Garth and Rick and myself was there all the way. No matter whose idea the song was, or if it was halfway there, or, you know, it was finished. Most of our stuff then got finished under that workshop kind of circumstance, and that was just one of the things that came up that kind of created a little bit of tension in the group. I could see it, you know, hampering our collaboration, and it started bothering the spirit of it.
Robbie Robertson, in I guess it was 76, decided he wanted to leave the band, and that the band should break up and have this big finale concert and go out with a real bang. You didn't want the band to break up, so you tried to resist that, but I guess you weren't able to.
Well, I wasn't. By then, maybe the last waltz started back. You know, during some of the disenchantment that I felt when the songs didn't reflect what I thought was the true spirit of things. So by the time the last waltz came up, it was no secret our collaboration and I thought that the quality of our music had suffered. I didn't hear us getting better. I heard us you know, doing albums with old songs that we liked as opposed to getting in and really trying to grow a fresh crop of songs. And so I certainly didn't want to end the band. The last waltz, you know, didn't set right with me. But, you know, there comes a time when we all want to move on, and that's what we did.
Mm-hmm. Do you think you ever reconciled with Robbie Robertson?
Well, at this point, there's not a lot of reconciliation that has to be done. You know, that was the way I felt at the time, and it's this much later now, and we're doing good, and Robbie's doing good with his solo career, so it probably all worked out for the best.
We're remembering Levon Helm, who died yesterday at age 71. Terry Gross spoke with Levon Helm a second time in 2007, when he released Dirt Farmer, his first solo album in 25 years. It won a Grammy Award that year as Best Traditional Folk Album. It's remarkable that his singing on that recording was that good, considering that in 1998 he had been diagnosed with cancer in his vocal cords. He was able to start singing again 6 years later. And just before that, he began presiding over what he calls his midnight rambles. Intimate concerts with his famous and not-so-famous friends at the barn that became his home recording studio in Woodstock, New York. Here's the opening track from Dirt Farmer.
That's Levon Helm from his new CD, Dirt Farmer. Levon Helm, welcome to Fresh Air. You know, I wasn't sure what to expect when I put your CD on because I knew about your vocal cancer. And your singing is so great on this, and it's so full out. And I'm wondering if the act of singing has changed for you, either technically or emotionally, since your recovery.
You know, it's a lot more fun for me these days. I'm not quite as hard on myself as I used to be. I still haven't fallen in love with the sound of my voice, but I am able to get some satisfaction when we try and do these tunes. And my voice don't sound a whole lot better than it did before I had cancer, but I had a period of time there for about 2.5 years or so where I had to just kind of whisper or either write you a note and tell you what I wanted you to know. And of course, there's nothing I can do except just be the drummer, which is my main ambition anyway. But it sure is a whole lot brighter of a future now that I can sing my part and help out with some of the lead vocals.
Let's hear another song from your new CD, Dirt Farmer. And I want to play The Blind Child. I really love your recording of this. I wasn't familiar with the song before. How do you know the song?
Oh, that's one of those old back porch songs that my dad and my mom and my aunts and uncles used to sing and play for each other. Those were Blind Child and Little Birds and The Girl I Left Behind. Those were some of the first songs that we started with.
You said you learned this song as a child. Did the song scare you as a child because it's about a child who's blind and whose mother's died, and it's a really tragic song?
Yes, it is. It's one of those story songs, a true to life kind of a song, and those were the songs that people really went for back then. Anything else was suspect. It could be something that somebody just made up, you know, with no real bearing to it. So songs like that were the ones that had lasted and stood the test of time when my folks came along.
Well, let's hear Blind Child, and this is from Levon Helm's new CD, Dirt Farmer.
They tell me, Father, that tonight you will in your arms where my dear mother died. They say
married to. They named my mother War. But tell me, Father, is she kind? Someone you loved before? And is her step so soft and light? Her voice so meek and mild? And tell me, Father, will she love your blind and helpless child?
You know, I'm interested in the fact that you've done an album of largely traditional songs and more contemporary songs written in the manner of traditional songs. You know, I listened back to our 1993 interview a few days ago, and I had quoted to you something in your memoir, which was published in 93, and you had said that you were reluctant to record with Dylan initially because you thought Dylan was too folky. And in the interview, you said we, meaning your band at the time, the Hawks, we were more into R&B and blues music. We weren't big folk fans. We liked horns, rhythm sections. We liked the full house on the bandstand. And Bob Dylan was coming from more of a troubadour kind of place, just him and his guitar. What happened between then and now to change your mind about recording folk music?
Well, it sounds like we all got religion, don't it? Yeah, you know, what I meant to say, I guess, is I still kind of feel that way. I'm a drummer, and Bob was a strummer without a drummer when we first ran into each other. So, you know, I'm just not drawn to songs that don't involve a set of drums and a full rhythm section.
So do you feel like you transform certain traditional folk songs by putting your beat behind them?
Well, I think I've made it a little bit easier in spots, maybe a little more danceable.
Mm-hmm.
And hopefully I've made it, easier for people from my school, the Full House Rhythm Section School, to hear.
Since 2006, you've been doing midnight rambles.
Yeah.
At your home and studio.
Uh-huh.
And these are just, you describe what they are.
Well, they're basically music parties. We have, you know, two, three, sometimes one a week, at least two or three a month. And we have them on Saturday nights in Woodstock at the studio. And it started out as basically a modern version of the old-fashioned rent party, but since then, the musicians that have taken part in it have really raised it to another level. And I guess it's 3 years, going on 4 years later now, and we have people that are coming in from all over the place to celebrate with us. And that includes the players, too.
Did you need it as a rent party? Because I know after you got sick, you had to declare bankruptcy.
This is true. Well, it started off as a rent party, so to speak. It looked like the studio was going to be put on the blocks because I was in pretty rough shape financially. And just as I started to kind of get my voice back and I was able to work a little more, is when we tried the Midnight Ramble. And it paid the rent, so we basically kept it up. And now this much later, it's really turned into a benefit for a lot of the players.
Now, you named the Midnight Ramble after concerts that you saw as a child growing up in Arkansas. Describe the Midnight Rambles that yours are named after.
Well, there used to be one of my favorite traveling tent shows at the time was an outfit called, it was called the F.S. Walcott's Original Rabbit's Foot Minstrels. And this was a big five-polar tent that they set up, and they parked two of the big tractor-trailer flatbeds side to side to make the stage, put the tent around that, and they had a chorus line, a band, a troupe of singers, dancers, and players, and they would put on in these small towns through the South. They would play every week, and you would go to the midnight. You would go to the concert. At the end of the concert, which would be over around 10:30, 11, they would offer a midnight ramble ticket. And for the people who could stay up late, all the kids were supposed to go home and get ready for school or Sunday school. And the grown-ups could stay and buy an extra ticket and get an extra half hour, 45 minutes of music and spicy or jokes. And one of the prettiest girls in the chorus line would do a little hoochie-coochie, and what a show.
Well, there's no like hoochie-coochie in your midnight ramble, is there?
You know, we've almost had it break out a couple of times. Amy and Larry Campbell's mom the other night jumped up and started doing a little hoochie-coochie.
Now, getting back to the midnight rambles, which are kind of like house parties, but on a very elevated level, you write in your memoir that your father used to perform weekends at house parties.
Oh, yeah.
Did he
yeah.
tell you stories about that, or were you old enough to go to any of them when he was still doing it?
Well, you know, by the time that I got old enough to go, televisions were just starting to come out. And we didn't get electricity and didn't have one yet, but the trend was started towards couch potato and... You know, just the participation generation was going by the wayside. And I didn't have a chance to play many of those house parties. I got to go to a few as a young kid. I remember one night they had one at my uncle's house. And my Uncle Pudge, who also played guitar, and I had a big grocery box. Pasteboard box, and I beat that thing to death that night. I was I volunteered to play percussion. But that was the old, move the furniture out of the biggest room, and a guitar player, a fiddle player, and maybe a mandolin player was about the strength of the band.
Drummer and singer Levon Helm speaking with Terry Gross in 2007. In 2008, Levon Helm took his Midnight Ramble show to the Ryman Auditorium in Nashville. Here they are, with Sheryl Crow as guest vocalist.
Where she stands on the banks of the mighty Mississippi, a lonely old gambler who said that he'd return tonight. They used to waltz on the banks of the mighty Mississippi, loving the whole night through, till the riverboat gambler went off to make a killing.
Let me choose another song from the new CD. This is Single Girl, Married Girl, which I believe is another song that you grew up with.
Well, it's just another one of those songs. It's kind of in that same area there. And it gave me as a drummer another opportunity to kind of monkey up the beat of a traditional country rhythm.
So here it is from Levon Helm's new CD, Dirt Farmer.
One, two, three. So fine, she dressed so fine. Oh, she
That's Single Girl, Married Girl from Levon Helm's new CD, Dirt Farmer. There's such great harmonies on your CD, and your daughter, Amy, does most of the harmony singing on this.
Well, that's Amy and Teresa Williams, Larry Campbell's wife, and that's one of the great gifts from Dirt Farmer for me is the sound of Amy and Teresa's harmonies. We didn't know before Dirt Farmer that they would blend and sound the way they sound together.
I've asked this to other performers who have ended up performing with their adult children. But when your daughter was born, did you ever think, this is my future performing partner? She's just arrived.
No, I never did. I guess I had the same hopes for Amy that my parents had for me. I wanted Amy to be a scholar. You know, my parents wanted me to be smart and be a scholar, and the best I could do was graduate high school. And bless her heart, Amy, I got to say, she did finish school out at Wisconsin and made a beautiful picture of her in her graduating robe, and I'm so proud of her. But the same bug bit Amy that bit me, and she fell back in with the rhythm section as soon as she got out of school.
Now, you grew up singing with your family. Did you do a lot of tight harmonies at home?
A little bit. My mother and sister were so good at it that I stood around with my mouth open and listened for the most part.
So when you started to sing, if you were singing with your mother and her sister, did you say?
My mother and my older sister.
Your older sister. So you were used to female harmonies. So when you started doing harmonies with the band, did you have to kind of transpose male and female parts in your mind?
Well, you know, you try to. It just, depends on how much, athletic ability you've got in your voice. I've always thought it was easier for girls to sing harmonies because their voices can go to that higher plane so much more easy than a male voice. And I'm not sure they just don't sound sweeter and prettier.
Your father was a cotton farmer, but performed on weekends. What kind of songs would he do, the kinds of songs you've done on your new CD?
You know, he would probably have done, things like the up-tempo stuff that we do on Dirt Farmer. Some of those tunes he would have done. And I know one of the old songs, we didn't do it in this recording phase, but Settin' on Top of the World was an old favorite back then. Now, don't you come here running, holding out your hand. I've been your daddy, I've been your man, but now I'm gone and I ain't worried. I'm sitting on top of the world.
Yeah, and didn't Cream record that too? And of course, Bob.
You
Wills.
Know, I think they did, and
yeah.
I'm sure my dad, jumped the beat up like Cream did, to make it as danceable as possible.
Now, you performed with your sister when you were a teenager and won a lot of contests.
Yeah, my baby
sister. This is your younger sister.
Yeah.
Okay. And you read in your memoir that, in those performances, you would play harmonica, jew's harp, and slap your thighs. Are there ever occasions that musically that call for thigh slapping now?
Well, that's the old ham bone trick. When I was coming through school, that was one of the things that you wanted to learn how to do was ham bone. And that's, how you slap your hand on your leg and your chest. Like, I don't know if you can hear it or not, but like that. And it was just one of those things that you learned as a kid. you know, in the South Arkansas schools, and not knowing how to play guitar or anything, that was my first reaction to music.
So you were doing that before you had a drum kit?
Yeah.
You know, we've been talking about your music, but you've also been in a few films, including Coal Miner's Daughter, The Right Stuff, and most recently you were in The Three Burials of Melquiades Estrada, which was directed by Tommy Lee Jones, who also starred in it. And you have a small but terrific part in it. And I want to play that scene. Tommy Lee Jones in the movie is going across the desert to bury his friend in the small town that his friend wanted to be buried in. So he's on this kind of like almost epic journey, taking the corpse, like dragging the corpse to the burial place. And he comes upon you, a blind man living alone in the middle of nowhere, and you make a very unusual request. Here's the scene.
I'd like to ask you a favor.
Anything you want.
I wanted to ask you, if you can shoot me. My son ain't coming back.
Oh, he'll come back.
No, he told me he had cancer. And he told me to go back to town with him. But I don't want to go, because I've always lived here.
Well, we can't do it.
I don't want to offend God by killing myself. It's a problem.
We don't want to offend God either.
It'd be the best thing to do. You're good people. You need to go ahead and shoot me.
What a great scene. What did you do to get into character? You play a blind man who I think is probably older than you are. You have scars and everything, you know, around your eyes. So did you just kind of walk in and do it, or did you, like, prepare?
No, I'm just one of those guys that goes in and tries to do it. I don't know enough about it to prepare myself. You know, I try and sleep as good as I can, and just enjoy it. I enjoy being with people who do know how to do that stuff, and I've never had anything but a good time around any of those shows that I've had the opportunity to be part of.
You know, your new CD is dedicated to your parents, and you perform on that CD with your daughter. Are you surprised now at the power of blood? And I ask that knowing that, like, you know, you left Arkansas at a pretty young age, and traveling around as a musician around the world, as you did with the band, I would imagine it would be easy to lose track of your family. But family in your early life, and certainly now, is so essential. I mean, the way you describe it, your daughter helped you survive. She took you to your radiation treatments in New York every week during the duration. She sings with you now. She co-produced the record. So I'm wondering if, like, you know, family ties have a different meaning to you than you thought they would have when you were, say, in your 20s or 30s.
They are stronger for me now, and I've always appreciated my family and friends, you know, and those ties that bind us together. But it's like my music, this much later, and after you've almost got everything taken away from you. Once you get that back, boy, it's a joyful life that we've all been given. And, you know, you can really, you know, when you see a young nephew or a young person in your family that's blood related, and you see them for the first time, and they're not old enough to know that you're all related, but you can look into their face and they look into your eyes and you both know it. You know, we take it for granted, and you know, we enjoy that kind of thing without even a big thank you most of the time.
I want to close with another song from your new CD, and this is a Buddy and Julie Miller song called "Wide River to Cross." Can you talk about why you chose this song and why you chose it to end the CD?
It's just such a great tune, and Buddy and Julie Miller are some of the best music makers that we've got. And I just love them for helping me do Dirt Farmer.
This is a beautiful performance. Thank you so much for talking with us. And
Thank you, Terry, for calling. It's a pleasure. Thank you so much for playing the record.
We're really glad you're recording again and performing.
Oh, me too. Thank you.
Thank
honey.
You.
There's a sorrow in the wind blowing down the road I've been. I can hear it cry while shadows steal the sun. But I cannot look back now. I've come too far to turn around. There's still a race ahead that I must run. I'm only halfway home. I've got the journey on to where I'll find the thing I've lost. I have stumbled, I have strayed. You can trace the tracks I've made all across the memories my heart recalls. But I'm still a refugee. Won't you say sometimes even the strongest soldier falls. I'm only halfway home. I've got to journey on to where I'll find the thing I've lost.
Levon Helm, from his 2007 recording Dirt Farmer, singing with his daughter Amy Helm and Teresa Williams. Levon Helm died yesterday at the age of 71. You can hear the complete 2007 interview and an earlier interview from 1993 on our website, freshair.npr.org. And we are grateful for the many years of wonderful music he gave us. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Additional engineering support from Joyce Lieberman and Julian Hirschfeld. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Melody Kramer is our associate producer of online media. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. For Terry Gross, I'm David Biancooley.